This is Disability Beat, a public affairs program for and about people with disabilities. It's about social justice, community supports, inclusion, accessibility, freedom, and choice. My name is Vicki Nicewander, and I'm the host of this program and also the parent of a fantastic young woman with a disability.
The views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, associate station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated.
You are listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. This is Disability Beat. I'm Vicki Nicewander, and I am thrilled to welcome my guest and friend on the program today. Shirley Paisley is a longtime Illinois and national advocate, has served in many roles, and is now an author of a very, very good book called Shining a Light, Creating Pathways to Equity, Safety, Healing, and Justice with People with Disabilities. Welcome to the program, Shirley.
Thank you, Vicki. I appreciate being here.
So why don't we have you tell the listeners a little bit about who you are and what brought you to writing this book.
Sure. I am a longtime native of Central Illinois. That's how I know Vicki and her daughter. I've worked with people with disabilities for pushing 50 years now, and over the years became very acutely aware of violence, especially sexual assault, in the lives of people with disabilities, and began seeking answers and solutions. How do we prevent this? How do we help people recover when they experience trauma? How do we get accountability in the court? How do we get access to victim services? All of the things that people without disabilities were able to access when this kind of thing happened, but not so true for people with disabilities. And as I began looking towards retirement and thinking about my body can't keep traveling like this anymore, I decided I probably needed to write a book that can share the many stories that people have shared with me, but also the solutions and the possibilities and the potential for safety, the potential for equity and healing and justice. Otherwise, all of those just kind of go up in the air. You know, training is one thing, but when you can put it in a book, there's a chance that it will remain longer. I don't know how long I'll be on this side of the grass, and I wanted to make sure that what I learned from people with disabilities would be passed on.
Well, and very appreciating of the book and the content for sure. And it's a great read, and the storytelling in it is really, really incredible. But I wanted to ask you, what was your big aha moment? I mean, you were in the social services, you know, serving people with developmental disabilities for much of your career. When was it that sexual safety and equity and all those things, when did that become your primary focus? Because it has been for a few years now.
Yeah, it's probably been over 25 years maybe. Mm-hmm. And I think it first began when someone told me about an assault that they had experienced, a sexual assault. And as I was supporting them and working with the family and them and doing the hospital visit and helping them with choices, around do they want to report to police and all of that, it just hit me, I think, in the hospital waiting room that, oh my gosh, this person who assaulted her had access to this other group of people. Were there other victims? So the next day, I started talking to the other people that this person, the offender, had access to, and I already knew how to do investigations because I've been doing abuse investigations for years, but not focusing on sexual assault. And every person but one, there were, I think, 8 people, and 7 of them told me about sexual assault in their life. One, my uncle, my brother, my teacher, my neighbor. And I mean, by the end of the day, I was just astonished. I couldn't believe that many people with intellectual and developmental disabilities had experienced sexual assault. And, you know, my goal was to find out, were you safe from this person? And they had been. But there were all these other situations that had happened, and none of them had ever told anybody.
Well, and not only had, you know, you ran into all these people who finally told you about their experience, but how many people are out there who are not able to talk about their experience?
Exactly. And, you know, it's there's so many issues around this, I could talk forever. But yes, a lot of people can't talk about it, but I've had people who are don't use their voice to talk, that only talk with their bodies, be able to tell me that they've had experiences with sexual assault. I outline one very clearly in the book, I think. I hope you remember reading that one. That's one of my most profound stories, I think, who was able to tell me through motions and pointing and pictures and things what had happened to her. But yes, so what we can do, though, I mean, over the years, what I've learned from people with disabilities as well as professionals is that there are some things we can do to create safer environments, to have people, there's things people, self-advocates can do, there's things families can do, there's things professionals can do, there's legislation we can do, there's policies and procedures we can enact, we can work with, you know, hospitals so that the sexual assault exams are available to people with all different kinds of disabilities. If that's something they choose to participate in after an assault. So there's just a lot of things that I've been privileged to learn over the years that we can do so much better than we've done in the past.
Yeah,
and we can start educating people, you know, which a lot of times special ed students aren't privy. They don't have access to the classes that the other students have. And there's lots of curriculum now for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities and other disabilities on how to be safer and what is a healthy relationship and what does consent really mean and how do we incorporate that into our living and learning environment so that people can truly understand their rights and how to set boundaries. And there's so much that we can do. There's so much. And I've seen a lot of change. I've got a lot of hope. And I know that we can continue to progress as long as we all work together in this really important way. And one of the things, Vicki, I want to mention, even though my focus has been on sexual assault, as you probably learned from the book, I also worked really hard to help people have more meaningful lives and more happier lives and fuller lives.
I know, and I think that's how we initially,
less than or different than, they're more likely to be sexually assaulted. So I really wanted people to feel included in their communities and have wonderful connections. And have a meaningful life.
I think
so
that's really
kind of fits together.
That's how we connected to begin with, is working in that arena of helping people find better lives. And then this other work that you've been doing has impacted so many people in such a positive way that I've just been really impressed with the work that you've done there. I know that we talked a little bit before the show about the previous shows that have been done on Disability Beat regarding closure of institutions, state-operated developmental centers, and the like. Mm-hmm. So where do you stand with that particular issue, and how are the abuses of people with disabilities, you know, are they easy to discover in those settings, or is there a better place for people to be?
Well, I think, you know, the institutions are leftover services from when we segregated all people with disabilities, or the majority of people with disabilities. It's a leftover part of the history of oppression and segregation and discrimination. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I would like to see all of that gone. On the other hand, I do, you know, understand that there are some parents who believe very strongly and some people that may want to stay there. I don't feel like I have a right to tell a parent what to do. My work has been focused on what is the best for the majority of people, and I think living in the community is best for the majority of people. I do know that if you look at risk factors for violence, isolation is a risk factor for violence, so being isolated from your neighbors, being isolated from the community, being isolated from your family and friends, that's a risk factor for violence. So that's not good. Dependency is a risk factor for violence, and there's a lot more dependency when you're in an institutional setting. You don't have the empowerment you can in a home, in the community. I write a great story about that with Anna, where she'd never been in a kitchen before or had her own clothes before or got to access her clothes. Had never turned a light on before in the hall.
Yeah.
And so, you know, those are the kind of stories where you go, no, we don't want to go back to those days. We need to keep moving forward. We need to be community-focused, safety, healing, meaningful lives, community. You know, that's where my value base is.
Well, now, I know a lot of people who might listen to this program and hear you talk about community and people living in the community, and they automatically go to group home. that's mm-hmm. what you're saying. Is that exactly what you're saying?
Well, you know, if you look at a continuum of quality of services, you know, institution might be on one the left side, which is most restrictive. Mm-hmm. And then in the community in your own apartment would be maybe on the very right side, which would be the least restrictive. I know some group homes that are more restrictive than some institutions. So it's not really about the address. It's about the people that you're living with and the people that are supporting you. So to me, the least restrictive is usually the best. Some people need more support. I believe we can do that outside of the systems that we have right now. Like Jen Knapp talks about where she works in Oregon, and everybody there has their own apartment. And most of the people have lived in institutions before. And so it just is proof that we can do that. It requires a different set of standards and a different set of funding. And, you know, we need to move towards those community-based supports, I believe.
Yeah. You know, people who talk in favor of institutional care and big group homes and so forth say one of the justifications they will use is that it can be safer. It is safer than somebody living in their own apartment somewhere. So the question I have for you is, what are some of the things that family members and providers and people with disabilities can do for themselves and for the people that they support to help them be safer in the settings where they choose to live?
Okay. There are so many things we can do. So I'm going to try to give like three top things.
Okay.
For self-advocates, three for parents, and three for providers. But first of all, real quick, just what is safety? It's to be free from danger, injury, or damage. And I think there's different kinds of safety. And I don't know that I've seen this written anywhere, but to me, there's body safety. Is my body safe? There's social safety. Am I safe around people? And that you might be around some people, but not other people. Do I feel safe? Are my emotional safety? Are my feelings held sacred and respected in this setting? Sexual safety, and of course that has to do not just with physical sexual assaults, but my identity, my orientation, all of those things related to who I am as a sexual being, and spiritual safety also. And even though my work focused on physical and sexual safety, every type of safety is important. And if someone hurts you and you don't have a safe person in your life, how are you going to tell someone? And that requires emotional and social safety. So just wanted to kind of throw that out there, because I think we need to start with what are we talking about when we say safety?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of my examples will probably be around sexual assault, but I wanted to put that out there. And also, I think we should be having conversations about safety at our dinner tables, before meetings or trainings, in one-on-one conversations, because how is someone going to be able to share with us that they're feeling scared or not safe if we don't have conversations about safety? You know, I share what makes me feel safe in this setting, and you can share what makes you. It's just something I've really been pushing the last few years. Let's talk about it. Let's have conversations about it. Okay, so tips for self-advocates. First of all, I want self-advocates, and that's, you know, somebody with disability who advocates for themselves and others. I want them to know that if they are sexually assaulted, it is not your fault ever. It is always the fault of the person who hurts someone. Never the fault of the victim.
Mm-hmm.
And as a victim, you're not alone and there's help. I had to put that in at the beginning. So here are three tips for self-advocates and their friends on what you can do to be safer. Number one, pay attention to your feelings. If someone does or says or makes you feel sad, something that makes you feel sad or mad or weird inside, find a safe person to tell. Our feelings can help us make decisions. They can help us decide who we want to spend time with. And having a safe person to talk with is really, really helpful. It's not good to hold our feelings inside. Number two, use your voice. If something does not feel right, speak up. You can say no, even to your bosses or your parents, if they cross your boundaries. Sometimes we say no nicely. Like if someone touches my shoulder and I don't want them to, I can say, no thanks. Sometimes we say no loudly. So if they keep doing it or they tickle me and they won't stop and they don't stop when I ask nicely, I can say, no, stop. I can use my power voice, right? Some people are afraid to say no. I've heard this so many times. I can't say no. I'll get in trouble. That makes me really sad because we all have a right to say no to things that are harmful to us. So if you're just learning to say no, start with small things like food choices or an activity. And if you belong to a self-advocacy group or get together with friends, this would be a great thing to talk about and practice at a meeting or a gathering How do you feel about saying no to people and have that conversation? And how can we help each other be stronger to do that? And the third tip is ask for information, ask for education. If you and your friends want to know more about staying safe, ask your family or your staff for some education. You can even ask at your local Rape Crisis Center about education. I think the one in Champaign County is called RACES, R-A-C-E-S.
Mm-hmm.
They have education about bullying, healthy relationships, boundaries. How do you set boundaries? What is a boundary? Secrets, consent, abuse, reporting, a whole bunch of stuff. And you have a right to be educated, and you have a right to be safe. So, self-advocates, pay attention to your feelings, use your voice, ask for information. And remember, if someone does hurt you, it is not your fault.
You know, I think there are a lot of people without disabilities who could benefit from that advice.
Absolutely. Oh, my gosh. I had such a hard time learning how to identify and express my feelings because we didn't do that in my family, right? And it's been really hard. But, oh, my gosh, when we teach young children, well, everybody can benefit from that in so many ways. Oh, my gosh.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's talk about your advice for parents.
Parents. Okay. So we can't prevent all abuse. I hate to say that, but we can't. We live in a violent society, but we can reduce risk factors for violence in our child's life, whether it's an adult or a child. It's like reducing risk factors for lung cancer. We don't want to get lung cancer. Here's, you know, I can stop smoking. There's a lot of risk factors for violence. I think there's 25 or 30 that I've studied. It's a lot. But offenders look for people who do what they're told, who will do what they're told, who will go along with them, who are compliant, which is a word I hate. Well, let's teach this person to be compliant. So parents, if you have a child with a compliant program or goal, let's get rid of it. Because we don't want our children to always be compliant.
Let's focus on that just a little bit more. Because I think that, you know, when kids go into school, school is all about compliance. How do you intentionally erase that from the curriculum, especially if you're talking about a person with a disability who has, you know, acting out behavior issues?
Yeah, and I do a lot of, I've done over the years a lot of consulting with schools, with specifically with students who have quote-unquote acting out behaviors. So a lot of times they're having issues because they're victims of sexual assault, and they have no way to get rid of these feelings, or they're triggered by something in the classroom. So it's a complicated process, but one is, for my child, this is important that they, that's not going to be in their record. This is a risk factor for violence. I want my child to be safe and empowered. But you can also have parents meet with the special ed district, and you can have meetings with the broader group of folks. And I've done this with places in Washington State specifically, where we've met with the superintendent and some of the teachers and talked about how they can engage with parents, with families, on keeping their children safer. And that involves no compliance goals. We aren't going to go there. We're going to teach so-and-so how to speak up when they're having a hard day, okay? That would be a much better. We're going to teach them maybe how to do some breathing, but we're going to help them in ways that maybe they need some healing services, you know, if it indeed the acting out behavior is related to trauma. So we're going to work on the real issue and not just teach them to sit down and be quiet, because that doesn't really help anybody. Well, so, you know, there's the individual approach, and then there's the system-wide approach, which is really important. And I would be happy to talk with any parent group that wants to work with their school around that, because it's so important, and it's such a long history of this compliance. I've seen a big shift in adult services moving away from that. So we can do it.
Well, that is very hopeful. So before we finish this afternoon, let's make sure that we get whatever contact information you'd like to share with families.
Absolutely.
Were there other tips that you had for families?
I hadn't nearly got to the tips yet.
So oh, gosh, good. That. Okay.
Well. One, teach your child that they can say no to touches, even hugs with you and the grandparents. I know that sounds bizarre, but when we force children to hug other people, we teach them grown-ups get to decide who touches them. That is not a safe message for our children to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And when they're adults, they're going to carry that with them. Oh, other people, bosses can decide who touches me. Other people in authority. So, that's really important. And if your child needs help with personal care activities, this is a great opportunity to teach about privacy and consent. and asking permission before touch. I know that sounds really weird. I'm not going to ask my own child permission before I help them, you know, change or whatever. But it helps. Trust me, it can reduce the risk factor of dependence and emphasis on control. And you build an expectation of respect and consent. So when it's not there, they're going to react. Mm-hmm. So it's really a huge safety issue. The second tip is giving your child permission to make choices. And this can start when they're young. It can start at any, you can shift it at any time if it hasn't been happening. Any environment that emphasizes control increases the risk for violence. So you want to build their decision-making muscle. You want to build their communication muscle. You want to be the people, you want to be the folks they trust and respect. You want them to know you trust and respect them. That you were your partners in helping them learn how to make choices. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Have opportunities. And the third one is help your child learn how to identify and express their feelings, whether it's using a picture board, sign language communication device, their voice, whatever that is for your child, helping them understand this is what sad feels like. Oh, you look sad today. Yeah, I'm sad. You know, and try to have those conversations in whatever way works between you and your child. And that gives them a safe person to communicate if they're sad or mad or confused, whatever that might be. Mm-hmm. So that's my three main tips. I'll just say this. In one project I worked on for several years, we discovered that when we taught people with intellectual and developmental disabilities to identify and express their feelings and to tell a safe person if their feelings were sad, mad, confused, whatever was ucky, people were safer, and they weren't waiting for unsafe touches. They were telling on people before they had gotten to the point of being sexually assaulted. They'd start talking sexual with them, and they'd go tell somebody because it felt weird, right? And so it was really exciting to know that we could sometimes actually prevent sexual violence because people were telling anything that didn't feel right to a safe person.
So talk to me a little bit about the families, and a lot of teachers, actually, special education teachers in particular, encourage students to hug almost everybody, people they know and people they don't know. How does that play into this whole
thing? I have a problem with that. I mean, I wish we lived in a world where we could all be huggy, 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 but we don't. Okay. Mm-hmm. So we just don't. So one of the things when I taught sexual abuse prevention classes, I taught what I called touch options. And people, you know, would come, and especially right out of high school, and they would hug everybody. And I just saw, oh, my gosh, they're going to be sexually assaulted. I could just see it because they didn't have boundaries. And an offender looks for someone that'll go along with them, right? So we would teach touch options. So what are the other ways that we can show we care about people? We can do high fives, we can do fist bumps, we can wave, we can give them a compliment. You know, there's all kinds of ways we can show affection without hugging. And, you know, I never did like the huggers at Special Olympics. That just seemed weird to me to have some stranger come up and hug people.
Fortunately, they don't do that anymore.
I'm so glad. I heard that the other day and I was like, yes!
Yeah.
Yay! Yeah. So, you know, I think teaching people that there's a variety of choices, and then if they're learning to identify their feelings to make decisions, they're going to know if they want to hug somebody or not. And the other person can say yes or no, too.
Yeah.
Right?
The ones so I worry about, Shirley, are the ones who have been doing this their whole lives. This is the way they live. How do they unlearn that?
You with kindness and respect, you have a conversation and assume they'll pick up some of it or maybe all of it about, you know, I want you to be safe and this doesn't, you know, feel right to me anymore. And I think I've made some mistakes in allowing this, but this is what I think we're going to do. And there's a lot of different ways we can show people that we care about them. But don't just take all hugs away, you know, because that's not kind either. But you want to transition. So you start doing a few high fives during the week or a few fist bumps or whatever their choice might be. There's other ways you can show grandma that you care about her. You can show her a piece of art you made, you know. I've seen people force kids to hug their grandmas. And, you know, when I see my grandchild, I want them to hug me goodbye because I always see them every four times a year. But I would never force them to do that. And I'm okay with that. You know, if they want to give me a fist bump or maybe hug my leg a little bit, I'm good with that. But they'll look at me and say, don't you touch me without asking me. And I'm like, I never would.
Yeah,
been trained. Yeah. But it's really, you know, you want to be sensitive to the person's feelings because you want them to still know that you care about them.
Sure.
But you care so much now, you're going to help them do this a different way.
So before we run out of time, Shirley, let's talk a little bit about what tips you have for support people, whether they're group home providers
or service providers.
Exactly.
Yes. So first of all, we want to create an environment that equalizes power. So I remember someone told me once, I've been seen naked by hundreds of people. No one has ever asked permission. Mm. One way to equalize power is by respecting each person's privacy and honoring each person's voices and choices about providing personal care activities. There's other ways to equalize power by involving self-advocates in decision-making, running their own meetings, hiring, helping to hire, train, evaluate staff, I mean, serving on the board and committees. I mean, there's so many ways. The important thing that I want people to remember is that staff are partners with people receiving services, not their bosses.
Mm-hmm.
And you ask most people in services, they'll say something about my boss, who's that, my staff.
Mm.
No.
Yeah.
No. I mean, that power over relationships lead to trauma, yes, but violence. Second one, provide trauma-informed education on healthy relationships, boundaries, all those things we talked about. And again, many special ed schools aren't doing that. So if you're a teacher out there listening to this, you know, you want some help, I can tell you where there's free curriculum that's been tested with people with IDD that would be very useful in a school. Students at the grade at risk of violence need to be included in this education. You know, people with disabilities are 7 times the rate of risk for sexual violence than people without disabilities. 7 times. Let's educate them, right? And then third, and this will seem weird, but I think a third thing is to collaborate with the local rape crisis center. They can help with education. They can help with advocacy. They can do staff training. They can help with so many things. You know, they do counseling not only to people who experience sexual violence, but even to their family members, because that impacts all of us.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of information in the book about how to do all of these things and more. And I just want to say this, because I do have a lot of hope about the future of people with disabilities and sexual violence. You know, we know a lot more now than we did about keeping people safe, not only one person at a time, but how to create systems that are respectful, accessible, and inclusive. And we can do a lot together.
Yeah, and you've done great work in that area. We are running out of time, Shirley. I would like you to give the listeners any contact information for you directly if they're interested in talking with you or having you speak to a group, whichever, and then we'll give the information about where they can find the book.
Okay, thank you. You can email me at shirleypaceley@gmail.com. It's shirleypaceley, all run together, lowercase. @gmail.com. Thank you.
Okay. And the book is Shining a Light, Creating Pathways to Equity, Safety, Healing, and Justice with People with Disabilities by Shirley Paceley. Thank you so much for joining me today, Shirley.
And Vicki, it's available on Amazon.
Yes.
On Kindle and Bookshare.
Very good. Amazon, Kindle, and Bookshare. Recommend it highly. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Vicki. Take care, everybody.
This and other episodes of Disability Beat are available at weft.org/public affairs. For updates and information, join our Facebook page at Disability Beat Radio. To share ideas for guests or topics, email Vicki at disabilitybeat@gmail.com. Thanks for tuning in and have a great rest of your week. And you are tuned to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. Next up is Food Sleuth Radio and lots of great programming this evening after that. So stay tuned to WEFT.